Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Happy birthday, dear Philip. Happy birthday to you.
Oh, hey there, it's Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and we're all wishing Philip Glass a happy birthday.
Here, have some cake.
Oh, thanks. Oh my God, that's awful.
It's Cookie Puss, John.
Yeah, I didn't even know they still made those. And for our listeners outside New York, Cookie Puss is a ridiculous ice cream cake that's usually given to toddlers who don't know any better. Today, we're giving it to the most popular composer of our time on the occasion of his 75th birthday.
Thank you, John.
Today is Philip's 75th birthday. He'll spend part of it with us. And the Icelandic composer Johan Johansson tells us about a beautiful score he's done for brass and electronics after he's done enjoying some of Philip's cake.
Does anybody have a napkin?
First, we got to clean up here and check in on the news. So, a Ninth Symphony.
So you evidently, you had a chance to listen to that.
Oh, yeah.
Beethoven, Schubert, Mahler, Dvorak, just a few of the composers who succumbed to the curse of the Ninth Symphony. Really, this is a long-standing superstition in the classical music world, but Philip Glass has devised a way to beat the curse. This is Soundcheck, I'm John Schaefer, and today, on Glass's 75th birthday, his Ninth Symphony gets its U.S. premiere, and he joins us to mark both occasions. Also, the Icelandic composer Johan Johansson tells us about his dramatic blend of orchestral instruments and electronics. But let's start with Philip Glass. Yes, his works are played at Carnegie Hall and the Met, but he's also written music for Sesame Street and for Hollywood and collaborated with Paul Simon, David Bowie, and Laurie Anderson. Played on Saturday Night Live, been name-checked on South Park. Today is his 75th birthday. And once again, Philip, happy birthday.
Thank you, John. Happy to be here.
And congratulations. The Symphony No. 9 released today, number one on iTunes and in the top 40 on the iTunes pop chart. Number one on classical and in the top 40.
Yeah, but how could that be? It just came out today.
Well, there is a long line of people, apparently, to download the new symphony.
Well, that was great.
There is a long, long line of composers who died after writing their Symphony No. 9.
We hope to die after, not before.
Right.
We're bound to die after. I mean, that hasn't. We're not automatically immortal ties.
But the curse is, allegedly,
yeah,
you write the Symphony No. 9 and you don't live
and then
to
you
write 10.
Over. Right. And we have half of Symphony from Mahler to prove it, number 10.
Right.
And
Mahler thought he had beaten it by starting his 10th.
He finished two movements. And there's some confusion about the Schubert.
Right.
Numerology, but
and Bruckner as well.
But then, as I like to point out, the big exception, the major one, of course, is Shostakovich, who did get to 15.
And you wouldn't have bet on him when he was around like
no.
seven,
and
eight.
Honest, is he in the 40s? Isn't he?
Yeah. He wrote hundreds of pieces. So anyway, but there is that. Now, are you a superstitious sort?
Well, it wasn't so much that. It's just that all my friends were superstitious, so everybody was getting so nervous. So what I solved it, just to cut to the chase, I solved it this way. I finished number 9 and immediately began to write number 10. And by a month later, I had completed number 10. Well, not completely completed, because I still have some editing to do and so forth. So, because Dennis Russell Davies, who's the conductor of tonight's performance and of the performance that we've been listening to little bits of in the background, he asked me not to talk about number 10 until number 9 was premiered, which is going to happen in a few hours.
Right.
So I think it's okay to talk about number 10. So that's how I did it. I did number 10. I finished it. It's a 5-movement piece. It's the one that doesn't sound like number 9. I call it the not 9 symphony.
So by getting both of them out of the way at the same time,
yeah.
No worries about the curse of the ninth, as it's
that's
known.
That's right. Now Dennis wants to know when I'm starting on 11. But his unstoppable.
Wow, he doesn't give you a moment's rest.
Oh, well, I don't give him any rest either, as a matter of fact.
Dennis Russell Davies, the conductor, has been, a longtime compatriot and colleague of Philip Glass's over the course of many years. Let's listen to a little bit. This is Dennis Russell Davies conducting.
Yes,
is this the American?
No, it isn't, but I should say that Dennis was one of the founders with Francis Thorne of the American Composers Orchestra.
Right.
He's a composer laureate now, and he comes back every now and then to do a piece. He was here for 25 years.
Yeah.
And this was one of his return visits.
So this is Dennis Russell Davies conducting a little bit of the Symphony No. 9 at the top of the charts on iTunes today by Philip Glass. Little bit of the Glass Symphony No. 9. We'll be webcasting the entire symphony at 4 o'clock today on q2music.org. Philip Glass celebrating his 75th birthday with the American premiere of the Ninth Symphony tonight at Carnegie Hall with Dennis Russell Davies. We just heard the Bruckner Orchestra
of
Linz,
Austria. That's right. His regular orchestra now. He's been in Europe. He comes back to America now and then.
All right. Now, maybe not so surprising that a new Philip Glass symphony available for download for the first time today would be number one on iTunes Classical. The fact that it's also in the top 40 of the pop charts, though, says something about, not just the music, but also your place in our culture, Philip.
Yeah, but also says something about how our culture has changed. And that's what, of course, is most interesting to me, is that the people who might be interested in popular music will also be interested in art music.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a big change. As you know, John, you've presided over that change, so to speak, in the last 30 years or so.
Yeah.
And it's been a huge, big difference. Now, when you go to someone's house, this isn't just classical records, classical music filed alphabetically on their wall, which is all you, but now everything's mixed together.
Now,
which is kind of the way we experience music now.
Well, it is, but, people talk about, the age of the iPod shuffle, and people on their iPods will have classical music next to jazz, next to rock, but you've been working in that kind of in-between area.
I've been living in that area pretty much.
Yeah.
We just did this. My friends put together a party at the Poisson Rouge the other night, and we had the Ray Beats playing. You remember the band from the 80s?
Sure do.
Fode Sousseau was playing Cora.
The Cora player.
Yeah, Ashley McIsaac was playing a violin. Cronos Quartet was playing. Michael Reisman played with Signal. He plays the music. My son was playing with Ashley McIsaac. Wu Man was playing with the Cronos. To me, that was like a normal night of music.
Mm-hmm.
And for the audience that was there, it was... when I looked around me, quite a lot of musicians, there were a lot of people who were just friends, and it was an invited audience. But that was not a surprising evening for anybody.
So do you look, when you look back at some of your works, do you think, well, all right, these are symphonies, these are operas, these are classical, these other pieces may be getting a little towards the pop music realm?
Well, the problem is that I write them, and then I try to figure out where they go. And often, and in the beginning, as you, I'm sure you might remember, in the 70s, 80s, there was almost nowhere to go. I was playing in Lofts in Soho. I was playing at Alana Heiss's Idea Warehouse. Remember that whole thing and
yeah,
that experiment?
Yeah.
We were at the Guggenheim Museum. Marcia Tucker had a big show at the Whitney. I was at the Guggenheim.
So basically you would do concerts everywhere but concert halls.
I didn't get into a real concert hall until I did Music in 12 Parts, and I rented the hall that was a town hall in 1974. And I finally got to Carnegie Hall in 1979, and I rented that hall. And I sold out both of those. And if I hadn't sold them out, John, I'd be still driving a cab, probably.
There is that famous story of you and Robert Wilson selling out the Metropolitan Opera. What was it, four nights at with
No,
Einstein?
We only did two. We couldn't afford to do more.
Well,
what the Met didn't tell us, and they were co-presenters, by the way, but they made the contract. And it said presented by the Metropolitan Opera and Bert Hauptmann. But what they didn't tell us was, and we didn't know, was that operas sell out every night and they lose money.
Right.
We didn't understand the mathematics of operas.
And so then, the famous story of you a week after Einstein on the beach, two weeks after, driving a cab.
Oh, that was absolutely true. And Bob was back in Europe, not digging ditches exactly. We were both back working at making a living.
Mm-hmm.
But that was simply because we were too naive to. We didn't know how it worked.
Right.
But that's an old story for American artists to. You work into your 40s and 50s sometimes, mm-hmm. maybe longer. Some people never get out of the day job routine.
We're speaking with Philip Glass. His day job is being a composer of whatever this music is.
Whatever it is.
And now, Kronos, you mentioned they were part of your birthday party at Le Poisson Rouge the other night. You did a version of a Bob Dylan song for them.
Well, there was a double record made for Amnesty International, a benefit record for them. And the whole record were covers of Bob Dylan songs. And I got asked to do one, so I did That's All Right.
Don't Think Twice,
Don't
It's
Think
All
Twice.
Right.
And but we did it as instrumental. Then I found out someone else did a vocal. But the Kronos, I wrote it for them. But then they souped it up even more, which I am completely happy with. But I have to say that some of the, there's some kind of a Vietnam violin wailing away.
Is that with that? I thought maybe it was a theremin
No, it's either Vietnam or Cambodian. It's some... I don't know where David Harrington finds this stuff, but he did. And he might even been playing it for all I know.
The founder and first violinist of the Kronos Quartet. Yeah. Well, let's hear a little bit. This is Philip Glass's arrangement of the Bob Dylan song, Don't Think Twice, It's All Right. Bob Dylan's Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, arranged by Philip Glass for the Kronos Quartet. Who's doing the keyboard part in the background?
I don't think there is a keyboard, actually. I think it's just strings strumming
away.
There shouldn't be. But I was saying to when we was playing, I hadn't heard it live until two nights ago. I mean, I wrote and sent it to them. I never heard it live. Record just came out. And I said to a friend, I said, oh, my God, I hope Dylan doesn't get to hear this. Now, thanks to you, he might, for all I know. And my friend said, well, he'll probably be glad you did it anyway. But
are you a Dylan fan? I mean,
oh, yeah.
You guys traveled in different circles.
Yeah, very much so. But is there anyone listening to music with two ears and two legs that can stand up who wasn't a Dylan fan? We all went through that. And for good reason. I mean, this was one of our great American talents.
Mm-hmm.
What I was doing in that piece was trying to get back to the roots of the roots, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate.
All right. So
It was fun.
An arrangement of a Bob Dylan song. Soundcheck listeners, it is Philip Glass's 75th birthday today, and we're looking back at a long and prolific career. And if you've ever wanted to ask Philip a question or wondered about a particular piece of his, now's your chance. Call us at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or leave a comment on the webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck.
John, I have a show to do tonight. What are you doing?
Well, you may be a little late. No. Now, I mean, it's not only the premiere of the Ninth Symphony tonight, but, you know, it is today is your birthday, yeah. So you have never really been a guy who does a lot of retrospection. I mean, looking back.
Well,
and
not really, but the ensemble, which you know quite well, we go out and do, we call them retrospective concerts, because basically the music I wrote between 1970 and, well, there's about 40 years of ensemble music. And we just call it that, and it could be anything from 1969 to the present.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of music there.
Yeah, it's a big library of music.
When the Met brought back your opera Satyagraha a few years back, you told us that you referred to that as a gift, that they were sort of reintroducing you to an opera that almost struck you as the work of another person, because you said your brain no longer works. I was listening to it again this morning. That's just why.
I probably said my brain has been rewired since then.
Yeah. I mean.
By the way, Bob Wilson and I just have been restaging Einstein.
I know that. It was in Detroit just recently.
Yeah, we were at, we did it in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. We were invited there to do that. This was a very, Linda Brombach from the Pomegranates organization got this together. It took about 6-7 years to get it organized. It was really an act of love on her part. And but the interesting thing, John, is that people said, "Well, what's the difference between what's happening now and what happened then?" I said, "Well, now it looks the way Bob wanted it to look, and it sounds the way I wanted it to sound."
Ah.
Meaning that when we played it in 1976, so we got better at it in 84 and 92 when you might have heard it, but we can actually play the music now.
Okay.
And the lighting instruments are sophisticated enough to reflect his vision.
Well, you know, it's been mounted a couple of times in the intervening years between 1976 and now, and it seems to have...
I feel now that this is the strongest production we've ever done.
Wow.
And it is the original. Mm-hmm. It's the original images. It's the original music. What's happened is that the mode of presentation has advanced.
So the technology has caught up to the ideas.
Not only technology, but human skill.
Hmm. Okay. We're speaking with Philip Glass. It's his 75th birthday. He's got a big night tonight with the American premiere of his Symphony No. 9 at Carnegie Hall. Joe from Manhattan is on the line and has a question for you, Philip. Go ahead, Joe.
Hey, Mr. Glass.
Hello, Joe.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
John's intro mentioned your appearance on South Park, and I wanted to know, did you ever see that episode?
Oh, sure.
What did you think of it?
Well, here's my view of it. Being made fun of publicly is an act of love. You don't make fun of people if you don't like them.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had...
As the South Park guys have proven with their Broadway musical, with Book of Mormon.
I've had three New Yorker cartoons. I've had a cartoon in the Daily News. The cartoons are my favorites, but the South Park, there have been some other ones, too. There's some other TV ones, too.
Mm-hmm.
But they're always very funny. And what about Philip Glass Buys a Loaf of Bread? That was a off-Broadway play. And a guy named Hicks wrote it, right?
I don't remember who did
anyway,
it, but yeah.
He wanted me to see it. And it ran for an awful long time, maybe much too long. And I finally said, okay, I'll go see it. Get me a couple of tickets, but make sure they're at the back of the theater, because I don't want to sit in the front row, then I can't leave. And, you know, it was actually pretty funny.
Yeah. I thought the South Park episode was pretty funny.
If you don't have a sense of humor about yourself, then you really you're in a lot of trouble.
Philip Glass is my guest on Soundcheck. He's done a lot of collaborating over the years, dance, film, TV, poets, theater. And in this piece, a collaboration sort of after the fact with David Bowie and Brian Eno. This is a little bit of the Low Symphony. And this is the Varjava, sort of a reworking of the first of the moody pieces on the B side of that famous Bowie Eno record. Music from my guest, Philip Glass. In a moment, we continue our conversation with Philip Glass and take your calls, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And coming up later in the show, the Icelandic composer Johan Johansson joins us to talk about his latest score to the silent film called The Miner's Hymns. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The worlds of music, theater, and music theater are still recovering from the shock of this 1976 piece by Philip Glass with the dramatist Robert Wilson, referring, of course, to Glass's first opera, Einstein on the Beach. Philip Glass celebrating his 75th birthday today and visiting us on Soundcheck and having some birthday cake and taking some of your calls and, oh, by the way, premiering his Ninth Symphony at Carnegie Hall tonight. Philip, we mentioned Einstein on the Beach in Michigan recently, a piece that still stands up after all these years. Before the break, we were playing a little bit of the Low Symphony. Mm. Antonio in Mexico City leaves this comment on our webpage. I just have to say I'm honored to have my Low Symphony signed by Mr. Glass when he visited Mexico City during the early 90s. My first introduction to Brian Eno, David Bowie, and Concrete Music.
Well, it works both ways, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, because a lot of people discovered music they didn't know, and a lot of people who knew Brian and David came my way. So it's been a fruitful exchange.
Right.
Very, very good for everybody.
What was it in that music? You did a Heroes Symphony.
Well,
another.
It's very simple. Brian and David are very talented songwriters. That's what it comes down to. I wasn't even thinking particularly of doing a symphony. It didn't have a number. I think Dennis asked me to write a symphony, but I called it Low Symphony. And I thought, well, in the past, composers have taken popular music of the day and put it to music and into their. That would be true for the Russians, but a lot of different composers have done it. Dvorak, everybody.
All the way back to Machaut in the 15th century.
And I said, well, I said, if I were going to do that today, who would I pick? And I said, well. My feeling is that musical talent arises anywhere, regardless of gender, age, race, musical inclinations. Talent is talent. It's like gold. It just exists by. And what I like about David and Brian, and by the way, I never figured out who did what. And when I ask them, they don't tell me. you will never find out who wrote what and who what did what when. But when I listened to their I thought the melodic writing was so beautiful. And I called them, and I knew the guys, and I said, what would you think of that? And they were enthusiastic.
Mm-hmm. So Philip Glass's Low, and then Hero Symphonies, based on the music of Brian Eno, David Bowie. So coming back to the Ninth Symphony thing, do the Low and Hero Symphonies now have numbers?
They did. Low didn't have a number.
All right.
In the same way when I wrote, just wrote a violin piano sonata for Maria Bachmann.
Maria Bachmann, yeah.
And she said, well, is that number one? I said, it's not number one until there's a number two.
Okay. Let's take some more calls. Linda joining us from your longtime stomping grounds, Philip, the Lower East Side. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I've been dying to know this. My husband and his boss were sitting at the kiosk on Houston Street at first, and they saw you, Philip Glass, reach into your phone and discreetly answer your phone while you were having your coffee, and they said, oh, God, what is his ringtone? And it's been years, and we've always wondered.
I'll tell you. My ringtone, and I was using an Apple iPhone. It's the one it's just a standard one they have. It's the one that's called Old Telephone. And the reason I do that, my dear, is because that way I know it's the phone ringing. If I use the marimba or the car horn, I don't know what the heck it is. But I know what an old phone sounds like, and that's what it is. I'm sorry. On the other hand, I have made a Swatch. When they were putting sounds on their
watches?
Yeah, I did a Swatch. I just a Swatch.
You composed a,
I did.
A ding or whatever that is.
Whatever the heck it was, I did it.
Lynn's on the line with us from Cranford, New Jersey. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you.
I understand you just introduced Philip's music to your high school orchestra. Is that right? Or are thinking of it?
I have. Actually, my midterm exam this year was on minimalism, and I introduced his music and through art and drawing and sculpture. And we're very excited about your music, Mr. Glass. And I'm looking for a piece that we might be able to play with my string orchestra and combine our chorus here at the high school. The kids love the sound of the minimalistic music, and we're just searching through your repertoire, but having trouble finding something that would fit us.
Well, the one thing that you could do is there's a piece called Company, which is actually a string piece. It was originally written as a string quartet, and then I added a bass part to it, and it's done by string orchestras. Now, if you want to do it with your chorus, if I were you, I would just take that music and look at the first and second voice. Just look at your vocal chorus and look at the string quartet parts and copy them out for voice and add some words or some sounds to it and sing along with the string piece. I think it'll probably sound very good.
And do what, like solfege syllables, do, re, mi, fa, sol, or just ahs? And
John, let him figure it out. No, I think it would actually work. I think you'll be... First of all, it's written for string, so it's going to sound good. And it goes right into the range of your chorus.
Mm-hmm. You've done a lot of, you know, as many composers, Bach among them, did before, a lot of adapting, rearranging of your work. Have other people done that?
There's a wonderful arrangement that Jonathan Hasse has been helping with this,
the percussionist.
But he recently sent me a recording of a steel band playing the piano etudes.
Wow.
And then my little company, Orange Mountain Music, told me they got the thing and they wanted to put it out. And I said, yeah, I put it out. It's fine. But I had it, and it took me about a month before I had the courage to listen to it. And I finally put it on. I said, my God, it actually sounded pretty good. I just saw Jonathan Haas, because he is playing percussion, and actually he's playing the marimba part in the orchestra tonight. And I said, we were talking about it, and I said, and he said, you know, we're getting hundreds of calls from steel bands who want to play this piece. Now, my feeling is this. I look at the work of Bach. It's all over the place. It's on accordions. It's on penny whistles. You know, music is music, and when people love music, they'll play it on whatever they can.
Right.
What greater tribute could you have for a composer than that?
This might actually sort of lead us to a question that came in through our Twitter account, because it goes to, you know, the kind of the viability of music, of you know, people having the means of expression, you know, in their
yes.
homes and in their hands. And now with a computer, you know, everyone has it in their bedroom. The question from our Twitter listener is, what do you think about the economic viability of music in general for the future?
Okay. For the future?
For the future.
Well, I have a very radical idea of it. Because, you see, I think it's going in a direction that is unstoppable. I think all these things to try to preserve the... There are certain parts of the intellectual property which we can. For example, if someone wants to use a music for a film or for a fashion show, then they have to get the rights. But for most people, they're going to get it free on the Internet. My son, who, when he was 9 years old, was making little movies on his laptop, and said, Dad, can I use some of your music? I said, yeah. He said, where are you going to find it? He said, I can find it on the Internet. And he came back 20 minutes later and said, Dad, I just downloaded your whole catalog. And that's my 9 years. Cameron did that. So, okay. What I really think is that we're heading to a time when music will be completely free. Now, let me put it this way. What if every concert was free? What if every museum was free?
Mm-hmm.
What if every movie was free? And that was somehow paid for. We found another way of supporting it apart from individual tickets. What if you could go to any concert you wanted to, but you just had to get your ticket early? I mean, I can imagine a world in which music and art and painting and poetry would be like the air we breathe. And if that happened, that sounds like socialism. Well, of course, look, this is not an idea that will go over big with the Tea Party.
Right.
But if I think about what is the future, well, that's the future. We can't conceive of it now. We haven't figured out how to pay for it.
Right.
But we figured out how to use it.
Well, leaving the Tea Party out of it, I can think of a number of filmmakers, concert producers, musicians, fellow composers who might also have some quibbles with that vision.
Quibbles that may be, but you know, it's a snowball that's coming at us, and I mean, I don't know that we can do much about it.
Yeah. Philip Glass has been with us on Soundcheck. I want to get one last comment in from Harley in Queens. 1983, I was 13 or so, and my father, who had the most diverse musical tastes of anyone I know, said, "I want you to listen to this." He cues up Philip Glass's The Photographer on the turntable, and I have been a fan ever since.
Great.
And,
what a nice
and
story.
Right on cue, your collaboration with songwriter David Byrne here on this song called A Gentleman's Honor from The Photographer. Philip, happy birthday.
Thanks so much, John,
for being with us.
Very
this is Soundcheck.
To be here.
Philip Glass, The Photographer, and still to come, Icelandic composer Johan Johansson joins us to discuss his score to the film The Miner's Hymns. That's next on Soundcheck.